Hi, this is Roger Green, executive producer and host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This weekend, we are bringing you six conversations from episode six, our Friday conversation with global KOLs about the impact of the Rezdiffra approval on Thursday. This conversation focuses on the staging and screening of patients using NITs. Laurent Castera joins at the beginning of the conversation, which is helpful given his extensive research and knowledge surrounding NITs. Laurent points out that this is going to be a difficult challenge to solve, in part because we use nominal scores for fibrosis when in fact it's really a scale. As he points out, we never use 1.2 or 1.5, we just go F1 or F2. Panelists discuss some of the other metrics that they look at, including things like ALT, AST levels, that is basic liver enzymes, thrombocyte levels, and other patient characteristics that might tell us how healthy a patient is or is not. The group also agrees that education is going to be pivotally important to getting this right, mostly physician education. Louise Campbell talks about the roadmap that Madrigal showed of what they're going to have their reps and MSLs train doctors on, and believes that will be exceptionally helpful. Jeff McIntyre suggests that patient education will also be critical because patients are people who can demand or at least ask questions of doctors that will lead the doctor to do things they might not otherwise and to get more informed on related issues. The approval of a first drug indicated for MASH may be the most significant achievement in fatty liver disease in longer than anyone can remember, certainly since some of the major diagnostic decisions and assessments were made. The conversation is interesting, and our global leaders have a variety of perspectives, so sit back, listen, enjoy, learn, and when you're done, join the conversation in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Laurent Castera.
Of course, as everyone knows among experts present here tonight, is that distinguishing F3 from F4 is a bit tricky, including with liver biopsy. But on the other hand, as you know, it's fibrosis is a continuum. It's not like MASH, because MASH is going like this and fibrosis is a continuum. And again, I've been working for now more than 20 years in NIT. So, of course, this is I'm very happy today because I can anticipate there's going to be a shift in the way people are seeing liver disease and especially MASLD. And we're moving from a categorical scale, F1, F2, F3, F4, that is actually A, B, C, D, because you're not 1.2 or 1.5. You're either 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. And we know, of course, what makes a difference. Difference is 3 and 4 because it puts you at risk of developing liver-related event and increased mortality. So back to NIT, of course, this may be challenging how you're going to define people that are F2, F3 and not F4. On the other hand, it's obvious that liver stiffness will be one of the key NIT that we're going to use because we've been using it already. And then I think we need to stick to clinical practice and to make it simple. Let me take an example. Several years ago, Baveno has proposed the concept of CACLD, compensated advanced chronic liver disease, starting when you're 10 kilopascal. Then, of course, your liver stiffness increases, and we know that it's like a prediction scale, you know? The likelihood of developing events, of course, will increase with the liver stiffness. So, first of all, I think we need to be relaxed with the cutoff, and I'm a bit sick with this cutoff of 12.25 doesn't really make sense. You're 12, 13, and you need also to repeat because we know there's some variability when you're using liver stiffness. So at least you probably will need, like was included in the Baveno definition, at least two measurements that are consistent before you can make a decision. Ideally, also, you would need another non-related or unrelated marker. And this we can discuss further afterwards. Coming back to the cutoff, I think it's not unreasonable to have an upper limit around 20 because this is where things are changing and the likelihood of having cirrhosis is much higher. But you might use a very simple algorithm like, again, Baveno with a platelet count. And let's say you have a patient with 30 kilopascal and 80,000 platelet counts. It's pretty obvious that this patient has cirrhosis. And of course, you put it in context because if the guy is 60 years old, he has a high metabolic burden, the likelihood even increases. Whereas if it's a young guy with no metabolic burden, it's more unlikely. So context, platelet count, liver stiffness, you repeat, and I think you're on the safe side. Last but not least, from the data we have so far, the drug is pretty safe in cirrhotic patients, provided they're compensated. So I think this is probably, I mean, this is just speculation, of course, because I actually value what Joran or Zobair with Sig or Jan. I don't want to monopolize.
Roger Green.
We landed right in your wheelhouse, though, Laurent. So that wasn't monopolization. That was
Jörn Schottenberg.
You came on at the right time.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that was timing and expertise at work.
And I have to say, I agree with the thrombocytes. I think in clinics, I rely on them, and I like to see them repeatedly, and I can judge thrombocyte movement in a patient, assessing their, as Laurent said, progression towards more advanced disease, which is a continuum, not as fluctuating. And if you have this, in addition with maybe even an LT-AST ratio showing some shifts and FibroScan. So it's not going to be one marker, I think. It's going to be clinical judgment based on number of NITs. Maybe you have to factor in how obese the patient is, how valid the FibroScan reading is. Look at the confidence intervals or the interquartile range and then make a decision. But the label is so that we can do that. It allows us to do that. And for that reason, I think it's a good label for clinical use and patients.
Zobair Younassi.
I agree with Laurent with you, of course. I think the two tests sort of confirmation, especially for some of these tests are so easy to do these days, would be the way to go. And also looking at the clinical profile of the patient and making sure that, you know, I don't need to do a FibroScan to tell me if a patient has a platelet count is low or has an imaging of the abdomen that shows lots of collaterals. That patient has portal hypertension. I think the drug is probably safe in early cirrhotics and very well compensated cirrhotics. However, I'm going to stick with the prescribing sort of recommendation that we have. And I think the whole idea here in the discussion we are having as to how to really separate F3s from F4s, because the F4s are going to be the one, quote unquote, with compensated cirrhosis. I think what Laurent just said, and Jörn, confirmed that looking at two NITs, being flexible in terms of your thresholds, erring on the side of being safe and looking at a patient, making sure that the clinical laboratory signs are not clearly to tell you that the patient has portal hypertension or, you know, more significant fibrosis than F3. That I think is the way to go for now.
I completely agree with you, Zobair. I think also, of course, imaging and especially ultrasound is maybe informative, but it needs to be in good hand because, as you know, the specificity is good, but the sensitivity, depending on who is performing ultrasound, if it's an experienced, of course, ultrasonographer, it's okay. But I would even go maybe to CT scan sometimes when you have any doubt. Because if you have splenomegaly or collaterals, of course, there is portal hypertension and we're in a different league. So I think this is critical. Now, regarding the second test, this is a difficult question because FIB4 is, I think, very efficient in primary care because of its high negative predictive value. It's very simple, but still you're using platelet counts, so you overlap. But in a specialized setting, I would be cautious because data we have showed that there's about 30% of false negative with a FIB4 in a context of high prevalence of fibrosis. So I would be cautious. So you probably need a more specialized test. So one would qualify, of course, is the ELF test, but it's not widely available. So maybe in the US, it will be easier, but in Europe or other part of the world. And also it comes with a cost and you need a platform to perform it. But the nice thing about the ELF score, it's unrelated. What I mean is, for instance, we know that the drawback of FibroScan are false positive in general, and especially in patients with obesity, let's say a BMI above 35 or 40, there's high risk of false positive. Whereas ELF is not influenced by BMI. So this is okay. And the limitation of ELF are not the same that for elastography. So if the two NITs go in the same direction, I think you're on the safe side. But of course, it's a trade-off between accuracy and feasibility in your practice.
Okay, I'm listening to this conversation, and one of the thoughts I'm having is that this entire discussion about NITs is about to shift because it's going to wind up not only with the folks who have the tremendous experience that you folks have, but we're now going to be looking at hepatologists and APPs who are actually going to be doing prescribing. I used to tell my drug clients that every new drug gets two sets of clinical trials. One is the one that gets you approved, and then the second is what happens in the hands of all the individual physicians who use it. And if the labeling says what it says, but the drug doesn't work that way in the hands of the physician, the physician will form her or his own impressions, and that's where they're going to be. I suspect we'll see something similar to that here with NITs. And one of the questions I've got is where, and I'll start with Jeff and Louise on this and then go back to the physicians. Where do you think the education will come from on how to think about issues of testing properly? You know, I mean, we heard Bill Siebold yesterday on the webcast give a pretty compelling list of all the things that their reps and MSLs are going to be working on, the Madrigal reps and MSLs. But this wasn't necessarily one of them. So I'm
wonder where you think that kind of insight and that kind of education is likely to come from, and what each of us can do to facilitate it. Because if folks don't get the NITs right, this isn't going to be the experience it could be.
Louise Campbell.
I think I'll go first and then leave it to Jeff. In the context of yesterday, they showed a lovely roadmap, and it's about physician education. By the time a patient often gets to a physician, they've already seen a nurse, they've already had their FibroScan, they've already interacted with the main areas of contact who will spend more time with them, given the limited amount of time a physician has to advise. So the collating all of that information is important. So therefore, giving the message of F2, F3 fibrosis, dietary information, and what's required with this medication is actually going to be given at an earlier time point. So it's about all practitioner areas being educated, because when a physician, or most of the physicians I've ever worked for, the better educated the patient is walking through the door, the easier it makes that conversation. And the patient should be the expert in their condition. It engages somebody. It allows them to be part and feel in control and ask the right questions. Because what happens is, if that doesn't happen, they come back to us as practitioners to ask us the questions. If we're not educated, we can't make those answers. We can't find the right information. So I think it's an all-person practice education for me. The concern for me would be non-invasive technologies going out without specialist delivery to endocrinology, cardiology, who now will have an opportunity to screen for disease. And that for me is the strength of what we provide, or where you go to a specialist provider, where you can discuss the serial testing of NITs and what they mean and why they're being done. So my concern would be only focusing on practitioners. But that might be just the start, because it's going to be practitioners prescribing these drugs to start before advanced practitioners or nurse practitioners in the UK and Germany and elsewhere in Europe. So that would be my concern about that education at the moment. But you've got Sunil Hosman now, the head of the NIT side. You've got some very good practitioners going in on the education team that I'm aware of. So I'm reassured by the level of education and the knowledge of the people being used. So that helps.
Jeff McIntyre.
Yeah, thank you, Louise. I think you gave some form to my initial whirlwind of thoughts on this issue, which is, you know, I think as you've heard me complain about previously, Roger, is, you know, if there's one thing that the field does really well, is that it points its finger at other places and says, you guys need to do this. And we've done it with primary care. We've done it with patients. We do it with providers. It just kind of happens all over the place, you know. And so we've come to this junction where one of the things that we've relied on in the past is, well, once we have a drug, then that's the miracle that will occur that will answer all of these other questions. And I do think it will be an answer in this. But in terms of all of this kind of circling back to education about non-invasives, you know, I do think there is a huge patient role in this. But I think it's, you know, there's no question. If you have a more educated, empowered patient coming into the clinic under any condition, and frankly, for any disease state, with good questions, the better that experience and the better that those outcomes are going to be, not just in this instance as well. I think it's interesting to say that in this, that, you know, you can use, when you look at the labeling on this, non-invasive are shown, but you know, you can use non-invasives with other indicators. It's not solely reliable on non-invasives in terms of this. We're all very happy that biopsy isn't required, but if you kind of flip that to say, okay, what non-invasive? We still haven't really landed on that non-invasive. You know, we still haven't really landed on what's that one thing. We talk about FibroScans, we talk about blood tests, we talk about these other things, but they're still not that quite at that degree of specificity. And so we need to continue the education kind of all around on this, that patients can be better informed about the non-invasives, and that the providers can be better informed to be able to use the non-invasives with another indicator of some sort to really help funnel the patients most at need here.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page on which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We'll be back Wednesday night with a group of patient advocates discussing their excitement, reaction, and next steps after the approval of Rezdiffra. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.